Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So it's Truth and Movies special live edition today. Shape of Water, sprinkled with fairy dust and possibly shot through fairy liquid. Guillermo del Toro's fable has critics wetting themselves. What do we think? The Mersey, ferries cross it. Now comes the movie, starring Colin Firth as the plucky Brit who sets sail for solo glory but finds himself alone and way out of his depth, but can't back down even as he sails to disaster. If only there was a topical analogy, eh? And a Russian winter, a bitter divorce, missing children. Get those sides strapped up nice and tight for Andrei Zvyagintsev's Loveless. All that plus There Will Be Blood as we give Blade 2 the film club treatment. It's Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. On Truth and Movies today, special live from Shoreditch edition, we have esteemed editor of Little White Lies, David Jenkins.
Hey, hey.
And make his debut today, in exceptional circumstances, Matt Thrift,
Hi.
Noted contributor to Little White Lies and general film blogger.
Yeah, and yeah, bits and pieces.
Are there still bloggers?
I don't know.
Do they still exist?
I lost mine in a big disaster.
What happened to it, Matt?
It was a Google disaster. My accounts all got hacked and then it just vanished.
Who would hack someone's blog?
I have no idea. Why would you? They obviously ended it.
I don't want mine, let alone somebody else.
The Russians.
Yeah, it's the Russians, yeah.
Now, here are some people who have been in touch. By the way, should you ever find the need to contact us, you can do so at truthandmovies@tcolondon.com. That's the email address. Or at LWLies on Twitter, or there's a Facebook page as well. We were inviting your comments on the Phantom Thread. Sean Hanrahan of Brooklyn says he thoroughly agrees about all the unanimous love for it. But please, for the love of all things holy, stop referring to his earlier film as Boogie Nights, because it's pronounced Buggy Nights. Did you know that, David?
Buggy Nights.
Buggy Nights.
As in, like, a buggy.
Yeah. I guess so. But so please, Boogie No More, thanks, says...
But I think if you pronounce buggy, I think because he's American, how would an American pronounce the word buggy? Buggy.
Yeah.
It might be a slight difference in how we say it and how he's saying it.
All right, we'll move on. David Fairley says, I loved the Ghostly Story episode with David Lowry. A bit early for this request maybe, but with Brad Anderson's new film Beirut out in April, maybe it would be a good chance to revisit The Machinist in Film Club. Who's seen The Machinist? Oh, yeah? Is that worth checking out?
I watched it last week.
Really?
Yeah.
For the first time? Or?
No, for the eighth, maybe.
Oh, right.
It's fantastic.
So that's resounding.
It's one in which Christian Bale goes thin.
Yeah.
It's the first one where he kind of, you know, speed diets for money.
Beirut, of course, the trailer incurred such controversy because of its supposedly stereotypical treatment of...
It's that... Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Beirut.
Yeah.
In fact, I actually grew up in Beirut.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How was that?
It was interesting, actually. I was mugged for my Action Man. True story. True story.
That's another podcast.
Yeah, that is another podcast. This one, though, continues with Shape of Water. Shape of Water. At a top secret research facility in the 1960s, in Baltimore in the 1960s, a lonely janitor forms a unique relationship with an amphibious creature that's being held in captivity. All right. It's mouth-watering stuff, judging from the trailer, David. How good is the film?
Well, I'm a big fan of the film. I'm among the lovers. I understand there may be a few haters out there, which we can come to later, I guess. I'm a big booster in general for Guillermo del Toro's films. In fact, weirdly, the one that I really don't get on with is Pan's Labyrinth, which is probably the one that is his most beloved. Because I'm such a big fan of his that, you know, I try and sort of condition myself to like it. And
what
do
you like about it?
It just seems like a kind of random series of events.
Right.
And then to have the kind of really brutal violence in it as well. And this film is kind of a piece with that as well, actually, because it is this very lush fantasia. It's about a mute woman who is the cleaning lady of at this underground research facility in America in the 60s. And there is a top secret asset which is brought in and is of interest to these scientists and security guards. And it turns out Russian spies as well. And I think the way he's pitched it is experiencing a science fiction movie from the viewpoint of a kind of peripheral character, someone who is kind of to the side of the main, of who you'd think of as being the main core dramatic people in the film, the main characters. So the film is kind of from the perspective of Sally Hawkins' character, who's called Elsa, who is this mute cleaning lady. And she kind of has these aspirations to, I guess, I don't know. She seems happy with her lot as a cleaning lady in a research facility. But then when she comes into contact with this amphibious creature who looks like a man, like a quite a strapping man, played by Doug Jones, who is a regular Guillermo del Toro collaborator. He played Abe Sapien in the Hellboy films. And he also played the Fawn character in Pan's Labyrinth. So they eventually hit it off, shall we say.
Well, yeah. It's interesting because it's very much set up like a fairy tale, this film. There's a narration at the start which talks about a sleeping princess and she meets her frog, if you will, and does a lot more than kiss him. But we won't go into too many details about that. Matt.
Well, I was just going to say, that the princess thing is kind of really interesting in that I think with this and with Sally Hawkins' character, Del Toro really kind of challenges the monopoly that Disney has always had on the princess narrative. So instead of having these Stockholm syndromed, dreamy, passive characters, this is a woman that has real determination and real sexual agency. This isn't a woman that's, you know, wishing that someday her prince will come. This is a woman that, as per her morning routine, is perfectly capable of coming all by herself. And he really gives a kind of voice to the, literally gives a voice to the voiceless with this, which is, you know, with Disney, something that you look at a movie like The Little Mermaid, where the character has her voice taken away in order and has to rely on her looks to. Del Toro kind of turns all of these things on its and subverts true. These things.
Well, David, you mentioned there's a lot going on in this film because you've got the post-Cuban Missile Crisis paranoia, you've got the Soviet spies, you've got the extraordinary Michael Shannon doing his thing. So there's a lot of tension about his intentions towards the asset and her plan to unite with this creature. And then you also have this extraordinary interspecies romance. Do you feel that all these elements put together, a hybrid almost as curious as the creature itself, do you feel that it walks and talks in a satisfactory fashion?
I was kind of skeptical about the film before I saw it, and maybe about half an hour in, I was very like, where's this going? What's this doing? Is this going to, you know, I was like unsure whether it was going to work. And by the kind of final sort of 20, 30 minutes, I was just absolutely, it just won me over entirely.
And but you're very soppy, of course.
I am very soppy and sentimental, and I guess there is a sort of sentimental streak in this film, but I very much feel it's earned. So maybe that would make it not sentimental, but actually kind of just emotional.
Matt, you're more hard-bitten.
I mean, I really like it.
You really,
really, really, really like it. I mean, it's what, Del Toro's 10th movie, I think? And it just really feels like a kind of summation of everything he's been saying so far. And I think what's so, you know, talking about the all of the Frankensteinian elements that it kind of cobbles together from different genres, I mean, you know, you ever seen an interview with Del Toro or follow him on Twitter? I mean, this guy is so literate and so intelligent. He seems to be able to take all of these disparate elements from 50s sci-fi to the old Universal monster movies, even the MGM musical, and kind of stitch them all together, but not in a way that feels like, a pastiche, like the artist, or this kind of postmodern wink job that someone like a Tarantino might put out. Close to a wink job at the start, yeah. So I think he ties it all together really well. I mean, I know that there are criticisms that you probably might be able to tell us a little bit more about.
I wasn't as swept away, but I'm just wondering, has anyone here managed to... I think you said you have seen The Shape of Water. Could we furnish you with a microphone? Would you give us your thoughts?
I'm the same. I'm a lover. I think I'm a bit mushy as well. So I got swept up into like the loveliness of it and the story of it. But I just think for me as well, it was just so beautiful. Like the whole thing was a really beautiful movie to watch. Like even that final scene, I don't want to give it away, but in the rain just kind of summarized it all perfectly.
I totally concur with that. I think one of the pleasures for me actually was the technical aspect of the film. Like he's thought about, you know, the ideas in the film and the references in the film and what it's going to say, what it's going to be about. But then I'm just staggered at the amount of time he's obviously spent thinking, like, how are we going to connect this shot to this shot? How are we going to move from this room to this room? How are we going to transition from this idea to this idea? And like, he's got a kind of visual device for everything. The camera will swoosh around and there'll be a crossfade and the colours will just melt into each other and you'll suddenly be in a new space and in a, doing something else. And, you know, he just clearly spends massive amounts of time. You think if you crack his head open, you'll just see the film in there because it's all there. You know, he's so immaculately thought through. So I get off on his kind of passion for everything, I think.
Very few people don't like this film. I just happen to be one of them myself.
Some of the some of the more critical readings I've read about seem to go at it for being simplistic, and I think it is really simple and really straightforward and not especially complicated, and it is unambiguous, but I think it's entirely coherent and cogent, has its own kind of internal logic that everything just kind of feeds back into this simple idea, which is just about tolerance. And yeah, you may be able to summarize that and it may not be especially ambiguous, but I think, you know, perhaps for a film that's talking about 1962 and that's talking about today, in a day and age like we have now, where, you know, from the very top down, we have these very explicit, baldly stated messages of hatred coming down. You know, what's wrong with a explicit, baldly stated message of love and tolerance? And
what's so funny about that? Absolutely, man. So I'm completely with you on that part. If we had to give it a one-sentence treatment to tell people what kind of film it is, would we say, Beauty and the Beast meets The Creature from the Black Lagoon? Or what would you say?
Oh, yeah, no, I would say something like that. Or just, you know.
Sally Hawkins sleeps with the fishes.
There you go, sleeps with the fishes. Magnificent. All right, well...
But no, we want to hear your...
Have any of you seen The Iron Giant, the Brad Bird animation? Mm-hmm. You've seen it. Yeah. It's a wonderful film, and there are many parallels between this and that, in that it's set more or less at the same period. There's that celebration of a kind of golden age of Americana in terms of the design of the film. And there's an otherworldly agent which is introduced into an American person's life, a kid's life in this case. And there's all the military who react with suspicion and fear and come down hard and try and destroy this creature. I think Brad Bird's an amazing director, certainly early on, the first three films he made. And that film, I think, has a real magic to it because there's so much chemistry between the kid and the Iron Giant, this robot that's arrived from outer space. And my issue with this film, quite simply, was I never felt the chemistry between Elisa, and the fish. And particularly where the moment where she floods the entire apartment block so that they can consummate their relationship, just for me was jaw dropping in all the wrong ways.
There's a right way for that to be jaw dropping.
There's a right way, and there are specialist channels for that kind of thing. But in this case, because I thought it was a beautiful film, and I appreciated the amazing design and the loving care, and it's such a perfect film visually in terms of the way that he constructs a world. It's almost claustrophobic how perfectly he constructs this world that we then inhabit, which is kind of 1962 Baltimore, but it's also not. It's another special place that only he has the keys to. And he sets this story there, and it is magnificent. The cast is great. Michael Shannon, always love watching him in a film, but I just never got the spark of their relationship, which is why, for me, I would give this high expectations, but actually wasn't that bothered. I'd give it maybe a 3 at the time, and yeah, maybe a 3. David, what would your scores be?
So I'd probably give it like a 4 in anticipation. I wanted to see this film, and probably 5.5 in enjoyment in retrospect, because wow. I'm very keen to see it again. And
super, Matt.
The same as David's. Yeah, yep. I mean, yeah, pretty much to the letter.
This one here is massively nominated for Oscars. How many Oscars? Oscars has it been
14?
14.
13 or 14.
A lot of Oscars.
It's a team.
Yeah, I think it's 13.
And Matt, you're all over Oscars. You're a big Oscar watcher.
Yeah.
And you think this is going to walk away with Best Picture, is it?
I think it's going to win Best Director.
Okay.
I think I would put my money on that. I think Best Picture... I think Get Out's got a really good chance at winning Best Picture.
How do you feel about that, Matt?
You know, it's. I liked that film.
Like, you liked
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I wouldn't give the Best Picture Oscar to it.
What though. Would you give it to?
Phantom Thread.
Okay.
Or Call Me By Your Name.
All right. The, yeah.
Or this.
Okay.
Or this, yeah.
David, you've never watched the Oscars ever.
No. I have a kind of really fun ritual of, well, it used to be getting up in the morning and then turning the TV on and seeing who won. But now it's getting up in the morning and turning Twitter on and seeing who won. So
that is fun.
Yeah. It's it's a personal brand of fun.
No.
But you watch all the speeches then on YouTube?
No. I don't. Like, that is literally my only engagement with it. I won't watch speeches or anything like that. I just don't want to be involved.
Does anyone have any strong opinions over what should win Best Picture this year?
I thought Three Billboards kind of started off as really, it's kind of quite titillating. It's quite, it's quite shocking. It's really, the humour is really sort of in your face. And I think as the film goes on, it becomes more and more mature and more surprising. And I think the all the central roles are just outstanding. And I can't think of a single film that I've ever seen that even remotely compares to it in terms of the way it tells its story. It actually surprised me, whereas, you know, most films don't really surprise me. Most films follow a reasonably generic sort of a process, mm-hmm. I guess.
One of the things I really liked about this film is that I'd seen the trailer for it, and then I thought, oh, that's what that film's going to be about. And then I saw the film, and the trailer was actually just like the first 20 minutes, and then it goes off and does all this other stuff, which is kind of jaw-dropping.
Super. Okay, well, when are the Oscars happening, Matt?
First Sunday in March, like 4th or whatever the first Sunday in March is.
Excellent. After seeing the trailer for The Shape of Water, Kevin Smith tweeted, "Seeing something as beautiful as this made me feel stupid forever calling myself a director." Praise indeed, eh?
Yeah,
do you want to make a rude comment now about Kevin Smith?
I concur with him on that.
All right, good. Excellent. Next up, it's The Mercy.
Dreams are the seeds of action. We'd all do well to remember that.
A single-handed race around the world.
I've already sent him my entry form.
Are you serious?
Alone on a boat for 9 months, you're either drunk or mad.
Well, we should have another drink so that we can rule out madness.
May I point out you don't have a boat capable of such a voyage?
We're going to build one.
Have you ever done anything like that before?
That's the point. If I can do it, then so can the bloke who stares at the horizon.
If I'm putting in the money, what are you putting in?
Everything else.
I fooled myself into thinking we were just building a boat. I didn't think I'd actually have to watch you sail away.
That's what boats do.
Promise me you'll come home.
Any sane man would want to pull out of such an endeavour. Leave your doubts with us here on the shore.
Good luck, Daddy!
Take your dreams out to sea.
Yachtsman Donald Crowhurst's disastrous attempt to win the inaugural 1968 Golden Globe race ends with him creating an outrageous account of travelling the world alone by sea. One sentence treatment for this, David?
Grizzly man at sea.
Grizzly man at sea.
If that didn't make sense to anyone.
So, okay, Matt has not seen The Mercy. Should he? And if so, why?
He should maybe see half of it and then sort of walk out. It's the story of the famous story of Donald Crowhurst. And it's set in this kind of magical era where the Sunday Times had the kind of power and glory to be able to sponsor a round the world boat race, which seems kind of magical to me. And this guy, Donald Crowhurst, he's a bit of a kind of dreamer. What works as a
He's got a small business, and they make.
Yeah, he's a sort of small businessman.
He designs equipment actually for yachting purposes. And I think that's one of the things he sees in this. And again, I think you get this from the trailer. He sees in this a way to demonstrate and give publicity to his innovations, the Navigator, which is a device by which yachtsmen can pinpoint their location. And I think he's also swept away in that the whole notion of anybody being able to go out and kind of grab an adventure, a dream.
And it's interesting because at the beginning of the film, you've got Rachel Weisz playing his wife, and he's got these two unbelievably cute little kids as well who are really into what he's doing. And there's this sense that you think he's doing this as a way to impose his kind of, I'm the patriarch of the family, and this is what patriarchs have to do. We have to, you know, we have to be manly and you know, yacht solo around the world. But actually, there's something. It doesn't feel like that. It feels like he's doing it for this very kind of abstract reason, which he only realizes at the moment where he's sat in the yacht in the harbor, and he's about to set off. And it is that point where he's like, Joe Bluth fans will recall, I've made a terrible mistake.
Is he like an eccentric or?
It's very much fudged about his eccentric nature. I mean, he's certainly a kind of affable chap, and you know, he's very kind of forward with people, and you know, he reaches out to all these people to get his trimaran made.
So we were having a conversation before about how it's impossible to see any film now without seeing Brexit analogies all over the place, and no doubt this is an issue which you've run into. Matt, you were having this problem with Darkest Hour.
Yeah.
Which Joe Wright at a press screening came out and explicitly said.
Yeah, just got up and said, not Brexit, not Brexit, not Brexit, before anybody had, you know, quite, yeah, preemptively worried that they might see this in this film that he made about Brexit.
Paddington 2, again, a lot of people have drawn parallels, and I think it's really difficult to watch. No, seriously, they have. But it's very difficult to watch this
Paddington
film.
Paddington is Donald Tusk.
In a sense, yes.
Yes.
But this film seems to fit so clearly to a certain reading of the whole Brexit issue, in that, is he an eccentric? Is he a chancer? Is he a man who's essentially still living under that kind of 50s delusion about what a British chap does, about that whole kind of Patrick Lee Fermor walking out and doing crazy stuff, of walking to the South Pole, of being the right kind of chap who could show a bit of moral backbone and conquer the elements, and indeed the rest of the world. So he dreams up this idea, and I think he also thinks it's going to be good for his business. But I think quite early on he realises that he's painting himself into a corner. And the kind of condemned man's shuffle with which he reaches the dock on the day that he finally leaves, I think speaks volumes about where he believes this voyage is going. And I think Colin Firth does a pretty good job in this film, actually, of portraying that character arc from being the father in of kind of 60s Britain to his kind of utter unravelling when alone at sea for 7 months.
I mean, I almost wished the film ended at that point.
Which point? When he gets on the boat?
At the point where he realises that he's made this terrible mistake and that.
But also, he's left himself no option because, as he, again, in the trailer says, I can't go home because I will have no home. He's effectively, to construct the boat, he has had to mortgage his home and his company. So he has effectively no way of going back. If he doesn't take part in the race, he will forfeit everything.
And I guess beyond that point, so the sort of the second half of the film is covering his, you know, adventure, quote unquote, at sea. It's based on a book that was written about. Actually,
There are a lot of logbook entries.
Yes,
and probably we should leave it at that.
Yes.
But the curious thing is that I actually really enjoyed the second half, and you really enjoyed the first half.
Yeah.
We should just buy one ticket now and swap over halfway.
Is this lost at sea bit? Is he just like bobbing, or
So basically, my issue with the film is that someone's obviously said, right, we've got a guy alone at sea. That's really boring. What can we do to like sex it up a bit? So there's all these like him sort of going around like, what's that sound? Oh my god, is it a dream? Is it a nightmare? Oh, is that my kids? Oh no. And it's all very kind of like, it turns into like psychological horror.
You're so uncharitable. I've had a hallucination on a boat before now, so I can testify to the veracity of the fact that he dreams he's seeing things. And the boat is terrifying, the kind of the oral soundscape of this.
It was built by the guy...
But the soundscape...
Caravan maker, right?
You said. Yeah.
It has...
you need to build a boat. Why have you...
Well, he knew the caravan maker.
I mean, okay.
To be honest, the whole thing is it's a kind of collage of well-meaning, well-intentioned, but desperately bad idea.
But if you're going to sail across the Atlantic, you wouldn't want a well-meaning boat.
Not just around the Atlantic. Then you've got to go into roaring 40s.
I actually like that. The production design of the boat is great because it looks like some guy's done it down the shed kind of thing.
So, all right. Now, you're mixed on this. Would you recommend it? You said go and see half of it.
Do you know what? We haven't really talked about her, but I actually think that the key thing I really liked about the film was Rachel Weisz playing his wife. And it is a kind of like she's at home and she's kind of pining for him. And in terms of her character, there's not really that much to do. But I just think she's increasingly in films now the most interesting element of the films that she's in. And like she's often in not great movies, but I always like her in them. Like My Cousin Rachel was another recent one where I thought she was amazing in it, but the film itself didn't really work.
Not that good.
I'd recommend it, but the director, James Marsh, his previous film, he did a film called The
Theory of Everything,
about Stephen Hawking with Eddie Redmayne, which I thought was the worst, really. Like, clawing my eyes out watching that one. So I went to this one with a certain amount of skepticism, but I think it's definitely, there's some good stuff in here. I like the fact that it wasn't too Oscar baity. It wasn't, you know, a BAFTA darling film.
Okay.
And it hasn't got any BAFTA nominations.
No, so, nothing.
So there you go. It's achieved that aim. So
I enjoy it. Have you ever, if anyone here is, I mean, not many of us have set off in a homemade boat to sail around the world, but we probably all of us said we would be able to do something and found us, maneuvered ourselves into a position where we effectively couldn't back down anymore because the loss of face would be too much, and we go through with this hideous program even though we know it's going to end in disaster. Yeah. And we've all lied about what we're doing, and we've all lied about whether it's our ability to handle finances or whatever it is that we've lied to, even the people closest to. And the way that eats away at you is something that is explored a lot in this film. So even though the sailing bit, that siren call of the sea, is not that universal a concept, I think the predicament that he finds himself in of having lied his way, effectively deceived people with the best intentions, and put himself in an impossible position, I think I found really affecting. And that whole dissection of the loneliness that he feels, being the only person who knows what's actually going on. So I would say that I wasn't expecting a huge amount, because I hate sailing, but I really enjoyed it. Maybe an anticipation 3 and probably a 4 at the time.
I would say probably anticipation, all 3s for me, I'd
all
say.
All 3s. Well, so, that's not bad then.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know, there's another film about Donald Crowhurst coming out later this year.
Yes.
It's called Crowhurst.
Yeah, and I, from what I understand, it's more of a horror, psychological horror film.
All right.
Sharkest Hour.
Yes. Save that.
Next up, Loveless. So, Matt, give us a one-sentence treatment on Loveless.
Life is shit, I guess, pretty much covers it. I mean, this is...
Specifically in this case?
In Russia. So this is the fifth film from...
Hold on. One second.
Yes.
Are there any Russians here? Okay, carry on.
Okay. So this is the fifth film from kind of Can darling and kind of pretender to the Tarkovsky throne, I guess, Andrei Zvyagintsev. Yeah, I mean, it's 2 hours plus of oppressive, relentless Russian miserabilism about the breakdown of a marriage that was breaking down before, and now it's really breaking down. And there's a kid, 12-year-old kid, that neither of them want to take custody of, that they want to send off to boarding school. And then one night this kid hears his parents arguing about his future. It's a really moving shot at the beginning of the film. And then suddenly he vanishes, and the parents don't realize that he's vanished until they hear it from
the school,
I think it is, yeah. And then suddenly they're off finding him. And that's that second act of the film, the whole kind of procedural element to it, which is this search party that is really great. And, you know, before maybe I'm too mean about it, it's, you know, this guy can really bloody direct. I mean, he knows, he's as a kind of master of form, he's, you know, he's really up there with some of the best working at the moment. However, I just think that for my money, I don't know, I think there's a certain pomposity perhaps, or, that comes with getting into the Cannes competition and then realizing that I now have to tackle these great, big, existential, national themes of identity and cultural and social malaise. And he really, really goes for it. Perhaps not as much as the one before, Leviathan, that he made a few years ago. But, I mean, he's described this. He's been at the BFI this weekend, and he introduced, because they've got the big Bergman season on, introduced Bergman's film Scenes from a Marriage, which is this five-hour, six-hour TV opus about a marriage in trouble and all of the kind of waves that it goes through. And he's spoken about how that film kind of influenced this one. And also his favorite film being Antonioni's 1960 masterpiece, La Ventura. And I think, you know, thinking of those films doesn't do this one really, really any favors for me. I mean, it's just a little too crude with its symbolic gestures, from the little kid that goes missing being dressed in a, you know, red and white tracksuit with his pale white face, you know, the colours of the Russian flag that are then... There's a certain shot at the end of the film that I won't kind of spoil that, you know, is a real kind of face palm of kind of...
Is this
crudity.
The shot with the running machine?
The tracksuit, yeah, which yeah. is quite
something.
I didn't something.
Find that objectionable. The when you see the film, the tracksuit on the running machine. Didn't have a problem with it. But then, so basically, what you're suggesting is that Zviagintsev,
yeah. yeah.
The child represents Russia.
Without doing too much of a digression, but Antonioni's great film, La Ventura, is just like this one is, about modern ennui or modern malaise. And just like in this film, in that one, a bunch of couples, a bunch of friends are on a boat off the coast of Italy, and one member of their party, Lea Massari, goes missing. And... She stands for this kind of existential, spiritual void in the middle of the movie. But what makes La Ventura, I think, one of the greatest films in all of cinema is that through the form and through the framing and through the way that he stretches time and space, he creates this kind of destabilizing, dislocating effect where you never really quite know where you are in relation to the characters, in relation to the narrative, even necessarily what he's saying or what it's meant to suggest. And Zviagintsev is doing something quite similar here, but all of those things that he's trying to do and what this kid represents is so specifically, quite crudely, I think, tied to a real specificity of right. narrative and theme and even genre as well, to the point where, you know, all of the answers are just quite kind of blatantly in kind of in front of you, I think.
You spoke about that really well.
Thanks.
No, you should do this for a living. It's terrific. And I must see La Ventura now. This, as you say, quite a different approach in that there yeah. isn't any attempt to stretch time or space. It's almost like watching an autopsy. I've seen this film described as. Basically, he's taking almost a pathological look at the malaise that has laid low the Russian corpus, as it were.
And don't get me wrong, he is an incredibly skillful director. Mm. So in terms of the nuts and bolts of it, you know, generating tension and the progression of narrative, I mean, he tells the story very, very skillfully and very clearly, and the midsection of the film, I think, is really impressive, if a little oppressive. I think also there are kind of charges. It's like there's the misanthropy and oppressiveness that hangs over the whole film. But I think
that one of the things that I found about this film that irked me is that there are these little junctures all the way through, so that there's these people searching for a child who essentially they don't really want to find, because this couple actually want to go off and have new lives, and the child is just as she mentions in the film, you know, was never really wanted in the first place. Constantly throughout the film, there's always the worst thing that happens does happen to an almost parodic degree, like over and over again. Like, everyone is worse than you think they are. The world is worse than you think it is. People are more cynical than you think they are. Mothers aren't the nice kind of swaddling and educational people you think they are. It's so... I don't know if cynical is probably the right word for it, but like, you want to take a bath after it, because it's so kind of like you may as well go and walk yourself around the back of the barn. And
well, that's funny. I actually quite enjoyed this trip through someone else's misery.
Oh, no, that's the thing. I think it's because, I mean, the film, just to add context, I mean, it is officially now Oscar-nominated, endorsed by the Academy, and he has sort of picked up many awards. And, I mean, you know, I think this film is very well-liked, and you know, I think I can see why. I mean...
So, okay, so it might be Antonioni for dummies like me, but I kind of enjoy this. Should I see Leviathan as well?
I like his early, still not funny ones. You know, the first three that he did, Elena, I think, is his best film.
Yeah, there's one called Elena, which is really great.
Right, okay, Elena.
There's another film coming out, I think, in May or June, called A Gentle Creature, which is another Russian film. And it was also in Cannes. And it somehow managed to be even more bleak than this one, which is kind of funny in a way.
Nice.
Long, slow, bleak, oppressive.
Oh, good. That's coming out then.
David, would you like to give your scores on Loveless?
I'd probably say like 3, because I wasn't that big a fan of Leviathan, and then probably 2 and 2. I just didn't really...
No? Didn't buy into that?
Didn't like this one.
Love for Loveless, Matt?
I'd go 4, because I really like his first few films. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess 3 when I was watching, because I think there is still a lot to admire there, and it wasn't until the second time I watched it that I kind of smacked myself in the head and went, he's doing bloody La Ventura. And that's when I really started disliking it. And then 2. Once I found that out.
Okay, so that's a separate question, I guess, whether repeated viewings should influence how you react to... Because most people still see films only once, unless they have kids, in which case they see them again and again and again.
I mean, yeah, definitely. Especially if a film has more to say there's more that can be got out of it.
Topically, I definitely got more from Phantom Thread the second time.
Did you?
Yeah.
Likewise.
It was a really, really different film.
I was giving the example before of Hot Fuzz on a similar level to Phantom Thread, of a film that I didn't actually enjoy the first time, but now absolutely love. Has there been a film that you have radically changed your mind about in a positive sense, didn't like it the first time, and then dug it afterwards? David, what about you?
Oh yeah, I have, like, big time. In fact, I think we've had this conversation on a podcast before, because it's the film Death Proof.
Oh, yeah.
By the currently controversial director Quentin Tarantino, which I hated the first time, really with a passion, and was like being really annoying and like asking people, why do you like this film? And then I saw it about maybe 8 years later. And
what did you miss the first time that you got?
It felt like more of an abstract film. It's got this weird structure and it doesn't really have a story and doesn't tell you anything. Actually, I just love this kind of very simple two-part revenge setup that it had, and lots more going on to it, like stylistically, and interesting film about his relationship to women as well. So,
I think there are definitely directors where perhaps I haven't got the first one or haven't appreciated the first one or two films of theirs that I've seen, but then once I've seen 5 or 6 or 10 of them, and then I realise kind of what they're doing and where they're going with their stuff.
Oh, right, okay.
You know, it took me a long time to get to loving Brian De Palma when I was like 18 to the point that I do now, and it's as soon as something clicks with what game he's playing, and then you realise that, and then you go back to the earlier films that you'd seen before and you watch them through the realisation that you've made later, then that was a revelation to me, going back to all of his films.
Nice one. Has anyone here seen Blade 2? Any of the Blade films?
Yeah.
Yeah?
All right. You all have.
Yeah. I have now, thanks to David, choosing Blade 2. So coming up next, it's our film club offering, which is, in honor of Guillermo del Toro, Blade 2.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Blade, lead the blood pack. Lighthammer, Verlaine, Priest, Snowman, Chupa, and Reinhardt.
Hey, me and the gang were wondering if you need to die.
What was that?
Can you blush?
Oh, I get it. I see now. You've been training for 2 years to take me out. And now here I am. Ooh, it's exciting, isn't it?
Blade, in Blade 2, Blade, played by Wesley Snipes, forms an uneasy alliance with the Vampire Council in order to combat the Reapers, who are feeding on vampires. We've invited listeners' comments. What were they, Matt?
I'm going to do this top one. I like this
one. Oh, you get the best one.
Go on.
No, you go.
Okay, so Blade. So my wife and I have an agreement when going to see movies. We take turns in choosing what films we see. Now, after seeing Blade 2, my wife said it was so bad that the next 5 picks would be hers. Now, I quite like Blade 2. I thought it was silly, but good fun. And any mention of this film now instantly makes my wife angry. And I was quite shocked to hear that the director of her worst film of all time is also the director of one of her favourite films of all time, Pan's Labyrinth. I like the fact that Blade 2 was so over the top and that it has a Bros superstar rampaging through the film. Thanks for the great reviews. Cheers, yeah. Carl Carver.
Luke Goss. No, is it Luke or Matt?
It's Luke Goss.
Luke Goss. Yeah.
He owes you nothing.
Yeah. David.
Sophia. Has written in to say, I saw the first and second movie, but can't remember them in detail. I think I like the second one more than the first because the second one explored Blade's parentage and we got to meet his mum and dad.
This isn't this film. She's talking about a different film.
That's the first.
That's rubbish. Yeah, okay, I'm going to read this one out from Angus Davis.
Didn't vet that one, did we? Yeah.
Angus Davis says, I found it a bit dull. Apart from some juicy fight scenes choreography, which is very good to be fair, and gruesome Guillermo's Little Shop of Horrors creature design, there's zero charisma from anyone on screen bar Carol Roden's brief appearance as a self-deprecating lawyer, and absolutely no character development to speak of. Karen Roden with the line, when he's asked, are you human? He says, barely, I'm a lawyer. I enjoyed that anyway. Maybe one of the better turn-of-the-century vampire flicks, says Angus. Any other comments from people who've actually seen the film? No. All right, gentlemen at the back then.
My name's James. I'm not sure I've got anything witty to say about the film, but I was sort of disappointed when I saw it when I was younger that they didn't keep all the blood and gore from the first film. And then on rewatching it, I think visually it's a much more interesting way of dealing with vampires and dealing with the
death. The way they explode with light.
Exactly. It's almost the opposite of what you expect, and I thought it was really interesting on rewatching it.
But there's that autopsy scene as well, which is like really heavy going.
Yeah, but it doesn't count in if they're dead already.
I guess. Oh, it's the violent deaths. Sure.
Guillermo del Toro regularly runs into plagiarism. There certainly is that with The Shape of Water, that there's been a claim that he's lifted the story from somewhere else. I mean, it's assembled from a series, The Shape of Water, of kind of well-known tropes, whether it's Beauty and the Beast or Black Lagoon or any of those things. But in this one, there's a good third of the movie that is taken almost shot for shot from Aliens.
The vampires themselves do have the little kind of H.R. Geiger kind of succubus thing going on when they're sort of, just to sort of give a visual to people who haven't seen it, the Reapers have a little kind of line down their chin. And when you first see it, you think it's a kind of trendy Middle European tribal tattoo thing going on. But then they get close to people and their entire sort of chins fan out.
It's a bit like one of those cargo ships.
It's a ferry and a chameleon mixed together.
How nice. Anyway.
No, praying mantis. Sorry, not a
praying mantis. Yeah.
Just to explain also the difference between the vampires and the reapers are the vampires, you know, they need a certain amount of blood to sustain themselves. And, you know, I don't think it's like once a day in this world. It's like a little bit occasionally. But the reapers, they're kind of genetically modified and they're like, they need blood like all the time. It's a bit like a drug.
Is it a Brexit analogy?
It's Brexit with drugs. And Matt Goss's character, Luke Goss's character, the main baddie, he's a kind of junky, martial arts junky, in a good way. That's me. I'm done.
It's kind of anomalous. This film in Del Toro's 10 movies.
Would you say so? Because it's funny. I saw this afternoon. Most of it, anyway. And one thing that struck me was how close a lot of the visual design is to The Shape of Water.
Well, what I was going to say was it's anomalous because it's the only one. It's a director for hire gig. It's the only one that he hasn't originated and written himself. So it's written by David Goyer. Boyer. But what's amazing about it, as you were saying, is the fact that even with a film that he hasn't written and a project that he hasn't originated, this is Wesley Snipes' baby, he still manages to put in all of these kind of auteurist thematic things that he keeps doing in all of his movies. You know, this whole idea with the two tribes of vampires of kind of cultural and ideological primacy that's in all of the films, whether it's Keiju versus Jaeger or, you know, insect versus human and so on. And I think in the sort of crucifixion of Blade at the end, when he gets tied to that table and all the spikes through him, you get one of Del Toro's kind of defining images there, which is that whole kind of conflagration of the kind of profane and the divine.
I suspect that if you read Del Toro talking about this film, even though I think that he has said that he is... it's not one of his favourite among his canon because it's, you know, he doesn't have that kind of close connection to it. I'm sure that he will talk to the cows come home about all the references and the links. And I spent the afternoon reading up on it and just the amount of little things in the backdrop, like, oh yeah, there's a sign on a club in the background that references like Vlad the Impaler, who was like the original vampire, you know, like, and it's loaded with all this stuff. I mean, he's taken it as a canvas and just run with it. And
is it in his top five movies?
Probably not, but it's probably
what is in his top five movies.
It's really fun.
He can do a great comic book movie, I think.
Do you know what I really liked about this, actually? And this is a weird thing, but like, so it's got this guy Donnie Yen in it, who is a big kind of martial arts. Is he from Hong Kong? Or?
I think so.
Yeah, and
he's in Rogue One.
He's in Rogue One as well. Yeah. Yes, and
he's also got Norman Reedus. Is it from Walking Dead? Early
and Chris
early
Christopherson role. From A Dolphin
Tale. Chris Christopherson and Convoy.
Yeah, and Convoy. Oh, yeah. And Wesley Snipes from Prison. Yeah.
So they have all these, I think, really great fight scenes, but they also mix the kind of the kung fu with like wrestling as well, like sort of WWF wrestling. Like they do like off the top turnbuckle kind of stuff.
Yeah,
I love that. Like, just let's throw some wrestling in there as well. You know, Blade's like a martial artist, and he also knows wrestling.
Damn, you don't get that in Antonioni, do you?
No, you don't. I think you know that's something that we've perked up. Loveless as well, just wrestling vampires.
A bit more wrestling. Yeah, vampires. All right. Well, thanks for that. Can we get a top five Del Toro?
For me,
yes,
it would be Pacific Rim.
Ooh.
Probably Shape of Water.
Mm-hmm.
Probably then Kronos. Mm-hmm. Then Devil's Backbone, and then Blade 2.
Well, yeah. Matt,
Shape of Water at one, Pacific Rim, Devil's Backbone, Crimson Peak, and Hellboy 2.
Really?
Probably, yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, no, Hellboy 2 instead of Blade 2. That just pips it.
Wow, okay. You guys, are you big Del Toro fans at all? Should we just waft a microphone over there?
Let's make a case for some of his
Yeah, also for Pan's Labyrinth, which I love. It's the only film of his that I really get into, because otherwise I think stylistically they're fine, but I just feel a bit empty about them. But it's all about you, sorry, not me. What do you think?
Well, I don't like Kronos. Sorry. Sorry, Wim. Yeah, that's a problem. but Pan's Labyrinth I love, and I love it more for the human aspect of it. And I know you said about the violence and stuff. I don't particularly like body horror stuff. Sometimes I squirm at, you know, ears falling off and things like that
in zombie films
and blah, blah, blah. But, in Pan's Labyrinth, I actually think that's one of his best ones because you care so much about the people in the, and you want them not to be discovered. And, yeah, so that's why Pan's Labyrinth for me. But I shy away from the more Devil's Backbone, Kronos stuff because it's icky.
That's the horror. Sorry, that's the reason why, like, the human character is the reason why the horror makes it shocking in Pan's Labyrinth, and that's why I think it works really well.
And now we're going to have an argument.
just to fill you in on the fact that Michael Jackson apparently was originally going to have a cameo in the House of Pain sequence, which I think that's when they first go into the vampire
house
world.
House of Pain sequence.
That's the name of the club they kind of infiltrate and they all dance into techno.
In that kind of vaguely Matrix-esque sequence. Anyway, there you go. That was Blade 2. What are we going to have as our film club next week? If you want to listen to next week's Truth and Movies, if you want to watch whatever this is that David's about to say, and then let us know your thoughts, and you can participate.
So the film
in
next
the conversation.
Week,
yeah.
It's I haven't actually seen this film.
Okay.
But I know about it, and I from what I understand, it's great. But it's linked with the release of Black Panther, and it's a film called Space Is the Place, which is a movie that's part of what's called the Afrofuturism movement in cinema.
This is Jimmy Faye, Channel 5 Stone Jive, the all-black station for all black people with all the news that grooves at noon, live from Oakland, California. As you are probably aware, several local mystics have predicted a landing from space this afternoon here at this spot opposite the Sector 5 government building in the person of a black musician and thinker named Sun Ra.
I haven't seen him yet. He should be here any time now.
He's reported to have disappeared while traveling in Europe in June 1969. He's reputed to have been traveling in outer space all this time with his intergalactic mid-science solar orchestra. And upon landing here, will reveal to the world his so-called plan for the salvation of the black race.
Where the hell is he?
It is now a couple of minutes past the time when Mr. Ra is scheduled to appear, so apparently he's not quite as efficient as our own NASA program people.
Is Black Panther an Afrofuturistic film?
Well, from what I've seen so far, Ryan Coogler has said that his main reference point is that era of cinema. So,
okay. Which era of cinema is that?
Well, it's kind of like mainly 70s and 80s, and it's films that mix traditional African dress and history and iconography with kind of like science fiction.
Okay.
So that extends beyond cinema as well, doesn't it, into music and art.
It's music, art. It's a bigger movement than cinema. So,
have you seen Space Is a Place?
No.
Okay.
No.
So we're all going to go into a little venture, an adventure film next week. Space Is the Place is our film club. The films that you will be reviewing, I'm not around next week, are Black Panther and Lady Bird. Just as a little sneak preview for the lovely people who come along this evening. How good is Lady Bird?
Good.
There you go.
Don't want to spoil it for next week.
All right.
Jeez.
All right.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
There was a lot of fuss about its 100% Rotten Tomatoes rating and that.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, okay. Excellent. Do get watching and let us know your thoughts by sending them to truthandmovies@tcolondon.com for emails, Twitter @LWLies, or find us on Facebook. Anything else, David?
That's me done.
Matt?
Going to go back home with Blade 2.
Okay. Oh, that's splendid.
Some vampire.
Well, listen, thank you ever so much, everybody, for being with us. Thanks to everyone listening there at home, but especially thanks to everyone who's been with us and everyone who participated and gave us the benefit of their thoughts on these films. Many thanks to Shoreditch House for hosting us. We apparently will be back next month, so look out for notices in the urinals about that. Or, if you can't wait that long, then the podcast will be up next week talking about Black Panther and so much more. Many thanks for your patience and have a lovely evening.
Hey,
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.